On September 28th, 2019, 13 days after Alicia disappears from her home in the middle of the night, a city bus driver in Phoenix calls the Phoenix Police Department with a possible sighting of Alicia. Glendale is in the larger Phoenix metropolitan area, and the bus driver's route takes him through both cities. The bus driver tells Phoenix Police Sergeant Joshua Jenkins that he believes he saw Alicia riding on his bus that day with an older man. The driver says the older man and the girl he believed to be Alicia got off the bus at a Fry's grocery store. I think this is the Fry's grocery store on East Jefferson in downtown Phoenix. The pair then took his bus back to the 43rd Avenue and Northern Avenue bus stop in Glendale. This is about a 20-mile ride round trip. The bus driver retrieves still images of the girl and the man from the bus's surveillance footage and turns them over to Sergeant Jenkins, who calls the Glendale police. Detective Mario Sanchez of the Glendale Police Department, the department's sole missing persons investigator who was assigned to her case on day one, determines the girl in the screen captures is not Alicia. He notes in his report that the girl in the photo from the bus appears to be a white female and her features do not match Alicia. The girl in the photo has a sharper chin line and her nose is pointier, Sanchez writes. The photo also shows that the girl's teeth don't have any braces on them. Even though Sanchez is pretty sure the sighting on the bus is not Alicia, it's interesting to me because this is actually not the first or even the second mention of a sighting of Alicia at a Fry's grocery store in the police file. Fry's is a chain grocery store, so it's not unusual that multiple sightings would mention the store, and it could be a complete coincidence. There are 27 Fry's locations in the Phoenix area alone. The first mention of Fry's comes in on September 25th, 10 days after Alicia's disappearance, when a woman believes she sees Alicia sitting on the floor in the produce section of a Fry's grocery store. The next mention is the bus driver's sighting. But then on October 9th of 2019, someone calls the police to say they believe they saw Alicia standing next to a gray Nissan Altima in a Fry's parking lot. If it's the same Fry's, I have no way of knowing, since the addresses are redacted from the police file. Then there's kind of a bombshell sighting, in my opinion, that is noted in the case file on 1-17-2020, January 17th of 2020. And this is kind of odd because the entry is in relation to a sighting that happened on December 31st of 2019, or New Year's Eve day of the year that Alicia disappeared. I don't remember ever hearing anything about the sighting before, but when I came across it in my reread of the police file, it definitely caught my eye. This is Gone from Glendale, Episode 8, The Fry's Grocery Store Sightings. On January 17th of 2020, a female witness calls Detective Sanchez and informs him that on December 31st of 2019, New Year's Eve day, at approximately 3:25 p.m., she was at the Fry's food store and noticed a juvenile female with long brown hair wearing a white hoodie with an older black male. She said the behavior between the two was strange, so she began to follow them. She said the male appeared to be grabbing the young girl by the wrist, and she was trying to get away from him, but he was dragging her to where he wanted her to go. The woman said that they both got into a white Town and Country van bearing Arizona license plates. The woman then followed the van to the Walmart at 75th Avenue and Lower Buckeye Road. But when she went to talk to a police officer about what she saw, the van disappeared. From what I can tell based on the location of Fry's and the Walmart, this woman followed the man for 20 minutes because she was so disturbed by what she saw at the Fry's grocery store. Even though this interaction took place on New Year's Eve day, the woman didn't report the encounter to police for several weeks because she didn't understand what she'd seen. But the white sweatshirt, long brown hair, Those sound like Alicia, and this is not the first time we've heard about a potential sighting of Alicia with a black male who is leading her around forcefully. The woman said it wasn't until she saw a post on Facebook about Alicia Navarro that she realized she believed the girl she saw on that day was Alicia Navarro. That's why it took her so long to call. She said the physical characteristics were very similar to those of Alicia. She also said that the girl in the store appeared to also have autism. She kept looking at the ground, and she said the girl also looked malnourished. The Town and Country van with Arizona license plates was registered to a 2006 Chrysler Town and Country with redacted details. That's all the information that we have about this sighting for now. There are a couple of other store locations and themes that seem to reappear in the police file, similar to the numerous mentions of Fry's, like repeated mentions of a sighting with a black man with dreadlocks and or facial tattoos, as well as repeated sightings of Alicia with an older Hispanic man. It's possible the sightings were all in reference to a single girl, but that girl was not Alicia. In fact, there is even a sighting in the police file where the police follow up on a repeated sighting, and when they track the sighting of a child to a home, they realize that there is a child living there who could be Alicia Navarro's doppelganger, but it's not her. On October 1st, 2019, Sanchez contacts Jessica, and I have to tell you that this entry in the police file is confusing and cryptic, but it seems important. I'm going to read verbatim how it's notated in the case file, but fill in certain missing words for comprehension purposes. On October 1st, 2019, Sanchez writes, quote, "I contacted Jessica, who said her daughter was seen in the area of redacted. Jessica said she was passing out flyers due to a person posting a video of a girl in the area that could be her daughter. Jessica spoke to redacted, who said she had seen her daughter with a black male walking to apartment number redacted. Redacted said the person in apartment number redacted is being evicted per the manager who is not in the office today." Jessica said an officer went out to this location and checked the empty apartments. Jessica gave me the names and persons who said they'd seen Alicia. That is all that's mentioned about this person who was being evicted. Sanchez then moves on to note that the girl on the bus footage is not Alicia, but she also informs Jessica. At this point in the police file, Sanchez also reviews that Home Depot footage I mentioned in the previous episode, and determines that that girl is also not Alicia. Once again, I want to reiterate that Detective Sanchez is the sole detective working missing persons in the Glendale Police Department. And that is in no way to bash Detective Sanchez, but just to point out that he is completely overloaded and lacking resources, and the responsibility he is given is way too much for one detective in his position to keep up with. There is a halfway house for registered sex offenders called Amigo's House, a half mile away from Alicia's house at the time she disappears. This is the halfway house I talk about in episode 7, Absconder. At any given time, Amigo's House houses about 8 registered sex offenders who live communally in bedrooms, the living room, and the garage, alongside former felons and other probationers attempting to re-enter society. But the first time the Glendale Police Department visits this halfway house, only 3 of those offenders are around to be interviewed. When they return for a second time, they learn that 2 offenders have absconded and 1 was apprehended by the feds the month prior. Police also discover that 1 registered sex offender who lived half mile from Alicia has not been seen since the previous Friday, October 4th of 2019, which was a violation of his probation. I do believe in respecting people's privacy, but considering this is a halfway house for sex offenders, many of whom have harmed children, and some of whom have absconded and are on the run, I don't think it's unethical for me to share this information. The halfway house is located at North 45th Drive and Montebello Avenue in Glendale. This is literally a couple short blocks from Alicia's house at North 45th Avenue and West Rose Lane. Among the men registered at that home, like I said, we know several have absconded. One of those absconding sex offenders is a 47-year-old man named Jesse Aurelio Uriatri, who has an extensive criminal record and was found and arrested again in 2021, although his current status is unclear. Jesse Uriatri's race on his registered sex offender page is listed as white, and he has brown eyes and black buzzed hair, though his hair is longer in at least one of his mugshots. Uriatri is 6'2" and weighs 230 pounds. He has a half dozen tattoos, and he also uses a wheelchair. Uriatri was convicted on 2 counts of child molestation and 1 count of sexual conduct with a minor in 1999, but he has a record of sexual misconduct going back to at least 1994. The court record describes Uriatri as a violent gang member back in 1999, and seeing as he's absconded and was on the run until 2021 when he was caught, it doesn't seem he's committed to changing his ways. Another absconding sex offender that lives in Alicia's area is a man named Jesse Samuel Celas, described in his registered sex offender bio as a Hispanic man, 5'9 and 165 pounds, heavily tattooed, including with tattoos on his face. Celas did not live in the halfway house. He lived about 1 mile from Alicia before he absconded. I don't really believe that whoever took Alicia that night was somebody who lives locally, at least not this close to her. While researching Alicia's case, though, I was alerted to another really disturbing case. And if you feel like this podcast has become a series of terribly disturbing stories of child predation, I can't exactly argue with you. There's a reason I share these stories, and that's because there are patterns that emerge and help us understand how these predators operate. And there really are so many patterns. In May of 2016, 16-year-old Haley Burns walks out the door of her Charlotte, North Carolina home to meet a 31-year-old man that she had met online. This man's name is Michael Wisolofsky. Haley's family would later tell authorities that Haley, who's been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, had left a diary behind that allegedly detailed her plan to run away with a 32-year-old man she met online. Michael Wren Wisolofsky was born and raised in Georgia and graduated from Oglethorpe, a private university in Brookhaven, Georgia, in 2010. At Oglethorpe, he studied economics, math, and Japanese. According to Wisolofsky's LinkedIn, while in college, he studied abroad in Japan and was part of the Chi Phi fraternity. He graduated magna cum laude and made the dean's list all 4 years. While he was in high school, Wisolofsky worked for Orc and Pest Control. After graduation, Wisolofsky worked as a tutor and in a variety of IT-type roles and as a business analyst. Haley describes, as quoted in an article from People magazine, how once she got to Wisolofsky's home, though, he tortured her, mentally and physically. He abused her and forced her to do sexual favors in return for food. In addition to being raped, tortured, and starved, Haley Burns was sometimes locked in a dog cage for hours at multiple locations in Georgia. Haley managed at some point during her captivity to get online and into an anorexia chat room. In the chat room, Haley was able to ask for help from someone living in Romania who alerted the authorities. And 13 months after Haley walked out of her house and was kidnapped, she was safely rescued by authorities. Wisolofsky was arrested in June 2017 after FBI special agents located then-missing Haley Burns at his Duluth, Georgia home. Haley Burns would tell the court during Wisolofsky's trial that in addition to the abuse she suffered, Wisolofsky, quote, lowered my self-esteem greatly and left me to believe I would never be loved or have a proper life if I gained weight. Burns, who suffers from anorexia, says she severely mutilated herself, hoping she would become unlovable so no one would hurt her like he did. The night before she was found, Haley's family received a message from a woman in Romania claiming she had been in contact with their daughter. Haley and the woman were chatting online when the routine revealed that she had been reported missing. The unidentified woman researched her case and reached out to the family. The Romanian woman messaged Haley Burns' mother on Facebook. When Haley's mother saw the message, she and her husband began communicating with Haley, who didn't exactly know where in Georgia she was because she'd been moved several times. Haley's parents immediately called the FBI, but investigators requested more information. When an unidentified tipster contacted Haley and asked where she was, the teen said she didn't know, so she sent a picture from the Duluth home window. Hours later, she was found. Here's the scariest part yet, though. Wisolowski got no jail time for kidnapping, raping, and torturing Haley, who was eventually able to escape. He pled guilty in exchange for 10 months probation, agreeing to register as a sex offender for life. I'm so truly appalled by this deal that I don't even know what to say. This man held a minor that he lured from home in captivity for 13 months. Prosecutors claimed Haley had been planning to run away for a while, and that she had even been searching the age of consent in Georgia, which is 16, and she left her home about 3 weeks after her 16th birthday. That's an appalling amount of victim blaming. It's as though they're saying because she wanted to run away from home, it's her fault she was held hostage and repeatedly assaulted by this person who was 15 years older than her. The prosecutor said that there were a number of things Michael Wisolowski made Haley do that she didn't want to do, but when you compare that with all the other information we have, the likelihood a jury would convict him would be low, he says. As part of the plea agreement, for 10 years, Wisolowski will have to abide by more than a dozen conditions, including a lack of contact with anyone under the age of 18, random searches of his electronics, and no possession of pornography. Wisolowski had a history of going on anorexia forums to target young, vulnerable women, according to People magazine. The DA said that when coming up with the agreement, he took Haley's experiences into consideration and hopes the probation will protect other women in the future. District Attorney Michael DiTardo says he understands the public backlash for the sentencing, according to People magazine, but says that during a federal investigation into Haley's case, information and evidence collected made it hard to prosecute the sexual charges. So, for everything that I've said about the sex offender registry in the past couple episodes, as important as this registry is, I mean, clearly the registry isn't deterring people from committing crimes, since you can register and then skip town, and for all we know, Wisolowski is out there holding another girl hostage as we speak. This is a reminder to use the Registered Sex Offender Registry to get informed about who your neighbors are, because you might be very surprised, but also to take it with a grain of salt that it might not have fully updated information, and just because somebody is a registered sex offender doesn't mean they're living in the place that they are registered to be living. And you can find registered sex offenders in your area just by Googling your city and the Sex Offender Registry. After researching this story and writing this episode, I discovered that Wisolowski actually did violate his laughable probation and was ultimately arrested and put in prison. And he didn't even last 1 year from his original trial date. Michael Wisolowski, so at the time, now 33, was arrested on September 17th of 2018 for violating his probation. He was found to have 3 homemade sex tapes of himself and an adult ex-girlfriend, violating special terms of his sex offender status. Wisolowski is barred from possessing any pornographic materials or, quote, sexually stimulating material, according to Michael DiTardo, the assistant district attorney who prosecuted Wisolowski's case. So after the second arrest, Wisolowski actually represented himself in a hearing pertaining to these charges, and as we know, anyone who represents himself is a fool for a client. Wisolowski argued that he had the right to access those videos because they were included in the case files from his original case, DiTardo said. And I guess what we can surmise from that is that the nature of these videos with his ex-girlfriend was violent. The videos were on a computer that was seized by investigators, but were never tied to any criminal charges. DiTardo argued there was no legitimate reason for Wisolowski to have or view the videos, as they would not play a part in any future appeal. You remember his punishment was just 10 years probation and that he couldn't access pornographic materials or have any contact with minors, including but not limited to Haley Burns, his victim. Judge Timothy Hamel revoked Wisolowski's probation for 2 years. Wisolowski was sentenced to 2 years of prison time. Following his initial arrest in 2017, when Haley was found in his home, Wisolowski had been sentenced to 9 years and 4 months probation and 8 months in jail with credit for time served. Wisolowski at that time pleaded guilty to first-degree cruelty to children and interstate interference with custody in April of 2017. The child cruelty charges specified the abuse stemmed from, quote, excessive physical pain during sexual intercourse, which allowed the court to require Wisolowski to register as a sex offender for life. An article in the Atlanta Constitution Journal explains that Wisolowski was arrested in 2017 after FBI agents and Gwinnett County Police found a 17-year-old North Carolina girl, Haley Burns, who had been missing for more than a year in his Duluth, Georgia home. The victim met Wisolowski on an online anorexia forum when she was 15. The victim was held captive for a year in homes in Decatur and Duluth. She was found by the FBI after reaching out to a woman online. The article continues that, quote, the gray area of the initial relationship and some inconsistencies in the victim's statements were factors that could have made it risky to bring the case to trial, DiTardo said in April. Wisolowski's lawyer refused to accept a plea deal that included prison time, and the victim's family prioritized a required sex offender registration, resulting in the plea deal that Wisolowski accepted. Again, it boggles the mind that a plea deal was offered here at all. I think a jury would have given this man jail time. But Haley's parents said they did not want to put her through the traumatizing process of going through a trial, which I also completely understand. I think law enforcement in this case shows a real failure to understand the nuances of victimology, and I think that is something we see in Alicia's case too. Haley is smart, but she had real challenges that made her vulnerable to predators like Michael Wisolowski, and to say that she is somehow complicit in her torture because she made internet searches on her computer or sought to leave her home feels like a fundamental misunderstanding of the fact that not all victims are a quote-unquote perfect victim. The district attorney also said that Haley Burns was a BDSM practitioner. Now, I don't think it's kink-shaming to say that regardless of whatever Haley was into, she was a minor and she was exploited. And state lines were crossed, as well as messages exchanged across state lines. So it also boggles the mind that there wouldn't be some kind of federal charges applied. Alas. I think we see parallels with a failure to understand the victimology in Alicia's case. The way that her disappearance was treated without urgency for so long, because everyone thought Alicia was just a runaway, but no one took the time to understand that even though Alicia is a literal computer prodigy, she might not have the ability to hop on public transit and traverse a city because that is not her skill set. She does not function that way. Hindsight is 20/20, but I hope the Glendale Police Department and other departments learn from how Alicia's case was handled, and that we can establish something like an Amber Alert for kids like Alicia who are endangered and missing, but maybe don't meet the qualifications for an Amber Alert. Because I know that as a parent, it is so frustrating to hear your missing child does not meet these qualifications. Following Wisolowski's second arrest, DiTardo said that the required sex offender registration is what is now sending him to prison for 2 years. Jail documents said that Wisolowski was due for release in September 2021, and I don't know his status at this time. But whether these measures are a deterrent for an offender like Wisolowski, I really don't believe that they are, and it feels like we're constantly using reactive measures to catch up with these offenders. The next episode of Gone from Glendale. Teachers and coaches across Arizona are fired from their jobs and convicted of crimes against children. And other offenders are caught, their victims returned home. Did Alicia think she was headed to the 2019 MagWest convention? If you have any information about the disappearance of Alicia Navarro, please call the Glendale, Arizona Police Department at 623-930-3000, the Anti-Predator Project at 305-796-4859, or you can email me, Alyssa Fleck, at gonefromglendale@gmail.com. If you think you see Alicia, please call 911 immediately.